When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Fails. Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years' War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluge.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered. Hey guys, welcome back to this alternative history scenario, which asks, what would have happened had Gavrilo Princip missed on the 28th of June 1914 while trying to assassinate Franz Ferdinand? I hope you're enjoying this take on what might have been, since I for one am re-enjoying developing this alternative world, though this episode here brings the story right up to the point that the Great War breaks out across Europe. What kind of Great War, you may ask? Well, let's find out. As I take you to a curious but familiar world, in July 1914. Milenko Vesnich had been rushed to the helm of the troubled Kingdom of Serbia on the evening of the 29th of July 1914. It is from this point that historians generally trace the beginning of the end of the European peace, and the so-called August Crisis is largely seen as the diplomatic precursor to the Great War. A series of cables passed between Belgrade and St. Petersburg over the 30th of July to the 3rd of August represent, it is now believed, the first in a series of requests from the Serbian Prime Minister for support in the event of a war with Austria. Vesnich was also said to have been emphatic about his desire to maintain the Russian connection, and he had written numerous works in the past, such as his PhD thesis, about the common fiery blood of all Slavs, including the Russians. During the course of this correspondence, Vesnich lambasted the recent Congress in Vienna, and claimed that Serbian sovereignty was now being impinged upon by the other European powers due to the Habsburg pressure, which was unduly exercised in Vienna's repeated insistence that Serbia must open the country for an investigation by a deputation of foreign powers, which it had yet to do. This had been one of the demands of the Congress in Vienna, and Serbia's failure to comply rankled European opinion, which remained pro-Habsburg. Governor Potjurek, that saviour of Sarajevo, was said to have been next in line to succeed Leopold von Berchtold as foreign minister, such was the sway he was now believed to command in the hearts of all Europeans, in particular the Habsburgs. Vesnich's distaste for this promotion was palpable, as he imagined Potjurek lording his position and status over the Serbs, and using it to wrest more concessions from Belgrade. Such was Vesnich's concern, and Vesnich claimed those of his allies, that he had been persuaded to launch a short, sharp war, not against Austria, but Bulgaria, the defeated power of the Second Balkan War. It is thus by late July or early August that the idea of a war launched by Serbia against Bulgaria starts to come to light. By creating this distraction and grabbing some quick gains for his country, Vesnich hoped to change the discourse in Europe, from that of sympathy with Austria to admiration of Serbian military prowess. To do this, Vesnich accepted that Serbia would need a casus belli with the Bulgarians, and it was in the course of this correspondence that Vesnich put to paper two key issues. The first was the necessity in making the Bulgarians attack the Serbs, and to make such an eventuality take place, the Bulgarians would have to be provoked and persuaded into attacking and immediately transferring the sympathy card to Belgrade. This sympathy card was considered by Vesnich to be an especially important resource, and Sazonov agreed. The second issue was the question of where Russia stood. Vesnich wanted to know if Tsar Nicholas II, a noted enemy of the Bulgarian Tsar, Ferdinand, would join in the war, or if St. Petersburg would remain a friendly neutral. These Vesnich-Sazonov letters, often shorthanded by historians to the VS letters, shed a revealing light on Russo-Serb diplomacy after the Congress in Vienna. It demonstrated the desperation present in the Serb government, which by early August still contained many conspirators responsible for the failed assassination attempt on Franz Ferdinand, though they had yet to be removed. These men were paranoid for their position and station, and so they collectively urged the likes of Nikola Pešić and then Vesnich after him to act quickly against, first Vienna, and when that didn't seem to work out, Bulgaria. That Vesnich was proposing the instigation of a third Balkan war to Sergei Sazonov did not seem to unduly faze the Russian foreign minister. Sazonov, in fact, largely agreed with Vesnich that the ascension of Potiorek to the Habsburg foreign ministry would be intolerable for the Russians and the Serbs and the French, and it may even put steel in the Austrian position when the Russians and French could least afford it. Sazonov claimed that Bulgaria would easily fall to Belgrade, and while he did maintain that Russia would support their Serb ally as a friendly neutral, he did warn Vesnich that complications could arise if the war was not quickly settled. Had that been all that Sazonov communicated to his Serbian counterpart, then the following war may not have been so controversial. Yet, that was not all that Sazonov said. On the morning of the 2nd of August, Vesnich again emphasised Serbian weakness in the face of a sceptical European bias against her, and he pointed to the divisions within Serbian society once more. This seemed to have done the trick for Sazonov, as he sent the now infamous letter in reply. Writing, "My dear friend will know of the concern I hold for his country's position, as well as his own position more generally. He can be confident in my sincere promise that, should affairs reach such a point so that it seems Serbian integrity is threatened, the Russian Empire and His Majesty will use all means at its disposal to safeguard the Serbian position, whatever this may entail. My dear friend may consider this check of assurance blank, and he may do what he wishes with it." Such loose talk seems incredible now, but we must remember that at the end of every letter the phrase, "destroy when read," is found. The VS letters, which have been translated into over 50 languages and now form the basis for primary source literature on the Great War, exist in their original manuscript form only in Vienna today behind a reinforced glass case, forever providing a testament to the guilt of the Habsburg Empire's enemies. With the blank check given by Sazonov to Vesnich, the latter now set himself the task of plotting an invasion of Bulgaria and presenting a fait accompli to the interested powers before anything could be done. The provisional date for the invasion of Bulgaria and the Third Balkan War which would result was set for the 15th of August 1914. With Russian assurance guaranteed for whatever would result from the invasion, it seemed as though Tsar Ferdinand of Bulgaria was doomed to another ruinous loss, as had been experienced during the Second Balkan War. Critically for the future of the 20th century, an accord existed between Germany and Bulgaria, which centred upon a massive loan given by German banks to the needy Bulgarians following the latter's defeat in the Second Balkan War. The Bulgarian Prime Minister since 1913, Vasil Radoslavov, had maintained a largely pro-German policy because of this, though Tsar Ferdinand's German ancestry was also said to have played a role. German financial claims on Bulgarian mines and extensive arms deals, which were signed in late July 1914, ensured that Sofia would be tied at least nominally to Germany, but on the 5th of August 1914 it was learned that Radoslavov and Bethmann Hollweg had signed a defensive alliance, apparently oblivious to the Serbian plans which counted down to the 15th of that month. 10 days before the war then, a war which Vesnich insisted was so critical to recoup the lost prestige and sovereignty of Serbia, it became clear that the planned invasion of Bulgaria would not be so straightforward. The real question, then, was whether Vesnich would elect to go ahead with his war plan, regardless. On the 7th of August 1914, amidst stormy scenes in the Serbian cabinet, it was decided that the planned war against Bulgaria would proceed as normal. Vesnich and his allies were adamant that Germany would not intervene, as the accord was known to have its detractors in Berlin as much as in Sofia. Vesnich maintained that the numerous financial bills which had been passed permitting German intervention in Bulgaria's financial sphere had been heavily and violently opposed in the Bulgarian parliament, and Vesnich believed that this division would ensure German neutrality. Either way, Vesnich argued, as the Serbian Prime Minister, the time had come for Serbia to strike. The current investigation into Serbian culpability in the assassination attempt of the 28th of June continued to erode public and national confidence, and it was rumoured that other Balkan states were planning to capitalise on the Serbian weakness by laying claim to portions of Macedonia. Furthermore, Vesnich argued, with the Ottoman Empire receiving two British dreadnoughts within a few weeks, Constantinople would also be a factor in the conflict, and her clear naval superiority in the region would pose a definite problem to Serbian integrity then. Thus the war was approved of, and Vesnich commanded the Serbian military to provoke, or at least formulate an excuse for the invasion of Bulgaria, in the early morning of the 15th of August, 1914. The impact of the Serbian invasion was immediate. The Serbian chief of the general staff, a Radomir Putnik, would lead the main thrust of the invasion towards Sofia, which was only a few kilometres from the Bulgarian-Serb border. Shock and a sense of anger seeped into the Austrian and German courts. Emergency memos were immediately sent to Berlin by Tsar Ferdinand of Bulgaria, requesting that the Kaiser mobilise his forces and come to the aid of his stricken country, as per the terms of their accord. Wilhelm II temporalised and he consulted with his generals. Meanwhile, Governor Potjurek, still an international star, petitioned the courts of Europe to condemn the Serbian invasion, pointing to it as proof of the Serb guilt and the low moral fibre of that country's character. In London, confusion reigned over why and how the Serbs had acted, and where Britain could possibly weigh in. Ireland, as ever, remained a distraction, with further talks on Home Rule planned for September, and the preliminary talks to take place at the end of August. There was little doubt that the Serbian attack had been a belligerent and aggressive act, wholly out of order with international law. That, at least, was something that the British cabinet could agree on. George V received a letter from Wilhelm II on the 16th of August, requesting that Anglo-German diplomacy yet again seek to defuse the Balkan tensions, as had been done in the previous Balkan Wars. Much was made of the fact that this conflict, the third within the Balkans in less than 3 years, displayed plainly the juvenile and dangerous nature of those independent states. "How much better for the peace of Europe," declared the Manchester Guardian on the 18th of August, 1914, "was that fell portion of the continent when it remained the responsibility of the Turk?" Though the question was, of course, rhetorical, there was much anger among the British people that the Serbs had acted dishonourably. Much was made of the Bulgarian weakness, the heroism of its soldiers, and the unfortunate hopelessness of its cause. Then, on the 21st of August, panic ensued when arguably one of the most famous documents of the 20th century was issued. It was signed by Kaiser Wilhelm II, and it declared Germany's unrelenting purpose to defend Bulgaria from attack. If the Serbs did not withdraw their forces from that country, Wilhelm said, Germany would be forced to take punitive measures. In Belgrade, Prime Minister Vesnich seemed to be leading a sinking ship. Though the invasion had gone incredibly well, it had to be said, with Sofia falling by the 20th of August, this success had drawn first Austro-German ire and then, the following day, a declaration to the effect that unless Serbia ceased its invasion, Berlin would respond in force. The great gamble of Vesnich, it seemed, had failed. Yet to both Vesnich and his circle of diehard Serbs, the game had not been lost. The Serbian ambassador to Russia was rumoured to have held extensive talks with Sazonov once the invasion began. The Russians, it seemed, were willing to intervene on the side of the Serbs if they ran into sufficient difficulties. From this, Vesnich could note with a level of apprehension mixed with excitement that their localized conflict had the potential to erupt into a wider European war. With this in mind, by the 24th of August 1914, when it became clear that Serbia had no intention whatsoever of withdrawing its forces, Kaiser Wilhelm II signed Germany's Immediate Danger of War order, effectively mobilizing German armed forces and issuing a bold statement to the continent. In this action, Berlin did enjoy the firm support of Vienna, and in most cases Rome, though the latter was hesitant to fully involve itself in these affairs just yet. In St. Petersburg, a hurried Russian response to the German mobilization seemed to prove that the Russians would not stand by and allow Germany to invade its Serb ally. The French ambassador, Maurice Paleolog, was petitioned by Sazonov to ask Paris where it stood on the situation, which had by this stage clearly descended from a situation into a full-blown crisis. It was at this critical juncture, as the courts of some nations in Europe seemed undecided on where to precisely act, that a turning point occurred which solidified European opinion against the Russo-Serb efforts. In a desperate counterattack which took the Serbs by surprise, Sofia was recaptured by the Bulgarians amidst national rejoicing on the 25th of August 1914. Thus frustrated, a trainload of Serbian soldiers meant for the Bulgarian border was accidentally left out of the national effort to respond to the Bulgarian move. This trainload of 350 Serbian soldiers, who had been stationed near the border of Serbia with Albania, took matters into their own hands. Arguing that they were acting in the name of Serbian national security, they roused Serb nationals in and around the Albanian border, and thus swollen to a force nearly 3,000 in size, on the 26th of August 1914 they marched into the small Adriatic country in force, massacring all Muslims and Albanian citizens they could find. When news of this outrage reached Vesnich, he became swayed by his diehard generals to capitalize on the breakdown in Albanian order caused by the unplanned invasion. Suddenly, 10,000 Serbs were diverted from the Bulgarian front to the invasion of Albania instead. By the 28th of August 1914, the entirety of Albania had been overrun and occupied by the Serbs, and countless outrages against the citizenry there had been committed in Belgrade's name. With this act of wanton barbarity and aggression, Serbia increasingly felt European opinion turning solidly against her. The Times painted the Serbian invasion of Albania as the most deplorable and outrageous crime against a peaceable people which was ever committed in the name of the national interest. But it wasn't merely the media or public opinion which mattered in Britain. Albania had, after all, been a strange creation. It was created by the different governments of Europe after the Balkan Wars to essentially keep Serbia manageable and prevent its domination over the rest of the Balkans through an ineffective port of access that it desired to the Adriatic Sea. The British consul in Albania had maintained a shaky Western presence in the divided country in the months before the Serb invasion, but law and order had hung in the balance amidst Greek claims on the southern part of the country, which was only resolved with the Protocol of Corfu on the 23rd of June that granted the Greek portion of the country near complete autonomy from the north. The Serb invasion of the country of Albania on the 26th of August was thus conducted through mostly Greek regions of interest, and outrages committed against the Albanian, but ethically Greek people, provoked Athens to issue a protest and warning to Belgrade to withdraw from the south of Albania altogether. When this was refused, the Greeks mobilized, and to preempt a Greek invasion, Serbia declared war on Greece on the 1st of September 1914. Now at war on multiple fronts, Serbian forces dug in along a wide front along the Serb-Bulgarian border, determined now to make use of their occupation of Albania and take the fight to Greece. The threat from Germany was apparently incoming, though once the Serbs had invaded Albania on the 26th of August, an international deputation had been sent to Belgrade to insist on the immediate evacuation, for the sake of peace, of all previously invaded states surrounding Serbia. While this was going on, incredibly enough, both the Germans and Russians were pressured to stand back and await diplomatic procedures aimed at salvaging the fragile peace of the Balkans. These diplomatic procedures, since termed the last chance approach, were blatantly and defiantly torpedoed by the Serbian declaration of war on Greece on the 1st of September, which we recently saw, that persuaded the seven nations involved in the deputation, Britain, France, Germany, Austria, Russia, Italy, and a previously neutral Greek representative, that peace in the region of the Balkans could not be salvaged. The Greek representative's protests were said to have been particularly poignant, and his denouncement of Serbian actions were picked up by foreign media outlets, which again casted Serbia in the worst possible light. With no reason now for Russia or for Germany to hold back, it seemed as though the war plans of both powers would be resumed. Not quite willing to give up on peace altogether, though, on the 2nd of September, Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands urged calm and invited all powers to what was called, somewhat sarcastically by historians since, the Congress of Peace, to take place in The Hague as soon as possible. Wilhelmina presented herself and the Dutch state as a neutral party determined to preserve the international peace, and through considerable British pressure, it seemed as though all would consent to this final act of peacemaking in Europe. Then, on the 4th of September 1914, it was learned that the Russians had invaded Bulgaria. With the Russian invasion of Bulgaria, ostensibly in support of their Serb ally, it seemed as though nothing could salvage the peace of Europe. Berlin, having already stopped and started its mobilization procedures twice in 1 month, resumed them again for the final time, with Austria-Hungary now in full support. Governor Potiorek, as well as Franz Ferdinand and Emperor Franz Josef, sent out the so-called Condemnation of the Slavs on the 6th of September, outlining every event in detail since the failed assassination on the 28th of June 1914. Taken together and disseminated across the various news agencies of the world, the crazy months of activity formed a vivid and distressing picture of Serbian and then Russian culpability in the destruction of the European peace. It also had the effect of massively turning European opinion even further against Serbia, but also, perhaps more notably, against St. Petersburg. On the 3rd of September 1914, mere hours before the Russians would invade Bulgaria, a further sideshow of the widening crisis had occurred, which Russian historians later claimed compelled St. Petersburg to involve itself in the unfolding conflagration. This event was the Ottomans having finally received their new dreadnoughts constructed from London. As the two new ships sailed through the Dardanelles, the Russians had looked on with great concern. Seeing the balance of power swing determinedly against them in the region, the Russians made the decision to launch a preemptive naval attack against the Turks, and in the so-called Gallipoli crime, the Russians destroyed one dreadnought and irreparably damaged the other. With their naval hopes dashed and years of popular fundraising to pay for these ships now underwater, the Ottoman government declared war on Russia 3 hours later. Shortly after this, in a display of what Belgrade termed its familial bond to St. Petersburg, the Serbs declared war on the Ottoman Empire. Incredibly, within a few short days, thanks to the paranoia of those behind the trigger, a Serb-Bulgarian war had mutated to directly involve virtually all powers in Eastern Europe, while the whole world looked on in rapture. Great debates endured in the French Assembly as Raymond Poincaré argued determinedly for war alongside Russia. If France failed to support its ally now, the beleaguered president insisted, she would be the victim of an invasion by the Austro-Germans. War thus had to be declared, and the spirit of the offensive allowed to unseat the German presence in Alsace-Lorraine, while this opportunity presented itself. Paul Cambon, the French ambassador in London, had been pressured extensively to bring Britain in on the side of France, but Cambon was having no luck. The Anglo-German Accord had become too strong and, what was more, Sir Edward Grey had insisted, public opinion was solidly against Russia and the Serbs. From Parliament, on the 5th of September, Grey gave a speech arguing against British neutrality and insisting that the Russian perpetration of the Gallipoli crime, not to mention its support of the European terrorist, as the media was now popularly calling Serbia, provided just grounds for British intervention. Furthermore, Grey argued, Albania had been guaranteed by the British government, and she could not now abandon her amidst this time of crisis. Upon presenting these arguments to his peers, Grey enjoyed the firm support of the House. Britain had treaty obligations to protect Albania, while its national honour necessitated that it did not remain aloof as Bulgaria was destroyed. The French issue was more difficult to determine, and fierce debate ensued as to whether French support of Russia would constitute grounds for an Anglo-French war, something which many MPs found unthinkable. Russian aggression and the destruction of Turkey's fleet in the Black Sea were circumstances eerily similar to the events leading up to the Crimean War, and heated scenes ensued in Parliament as many peers argued forcibly for a stance that would demonstrate British power and firmness in the ensuing crisis. The Eastern Question, the Conservatives insisted, had been revived, and the ghost of Benjamin Disraeli watched to see how all brave and true Britons would act in this great and noble national quest. Eventually, after much debate, it was decided that an ultimatum would be sent to Russia at noon on the 6th of September. If she did not evacuate her troops from Bulgaria and Turkey by noon on the 7th of September 1914, then Britain would declare war. The decision provoked scenes of passionate rejoicing in the streets of London. Here was the firm stand that the British people had been so desperate for. At this, the Russian ambassador to London, Alexander Benkendorf, protested that Russia was merely defending its national interests and position in the world, and that she could not be held responsible for what befell Britain if she did indeed declare war. He left for St. Petersburg amidst jeers from an onlooking crowd in the evening of the 6th of September. Lichnowsky, the German ambassador and a stringent Anglophile, signed an accord with Grey that evening, promising German support in the event that British forces were forced to engage with those of France. Through this, it seemed that the once committed Francophile Grey had made up his country's mind. If France opposed the British declaration of war by force, which Paris was compelled to do after all by the Franco-Russian Entente, then Britain would have to make war against France as well. As the developments unfolded, it was learned that Germany and Austria had declared war on Russia on the evening of the 6th of September, 1914. British crowds cheered the move, and many camped outside of Westminster till the following morning, when an official announcement of Britain's position vis-à-vis Russia would be made by noon. Paul Cambon communicated the terms of the accord signed between Grey and Lichnowsky on the evening of the 6th of September, which compelled Germany to support Britain in the event of an Anglo-French war. Paul Cambon, shortly after this, cabled home to Paris, communicating the terms of the accord signed between Grey and Lichnowsky on the evening of the 6th of September, which compelled Germany to support Britain in the event of an Anglo-French war, and this new information resulted in uproar in the French chamber. Poincaré could not believe that the nominal ally of France would act in such a way. In the past, certain individuals in the British military, it would later transpire, had engaged in secret talks with their French counterparts regarding the extension of the Entente Cordiale into an offensive alliance against Germany. Yet, now such talks had stalled in the face of the old Eastern Question, which seemed to throw everything out the window. Poincaré was outraged and argued for punitive measures to be taken against Britain before her navy could strike at French interests. At this, though, he was overruled, because many in Paris still held out hope that an Anglo-Russian war would not result from the crisis, but the prognosis was not good. Poincaré did attempt to use the incoming German invasion, predicted as per the Schlieffen Plan, the worst-kept secret in Europe, as political capital in Europe, but he could receive little support. The Schlieffen Plan, it seemed, despite the German declaration of war on Russia, had been put on hold. Indeed, the true significance of the two cousins' dinner on the 5th of July now became apparent. It was here that the Anglo-German friendship, founded along the lines of the royal families, seemed to have been permanently established. Now it emerged, amidst the German inaction of the Western Front, that Germany's military had been persuaded over the months of July and August not to invade France. British pressure, George V had then assured the Kaiser, would ensure that any military eventualities would render such an invasion unnecessary. Helmut von Moltke, chief of the German General Staff, for his part refused to abandon the Schlieffen Plan, which, after all, had been the lifeblood of his campaign plan for the entirety of his career, and after much tension and insult, he was replaced by the more flexible Erich von Falkenhayn on the 28th of July 1914. Moltke, for his part, was reportedly in tears that his life's work had gone up in flames. Historians would later present the German abandonment of the Schlieffen Plan as the best decision its general staff was ever induced to make. With the waging of a war on only one front and supported wholly by the British and most of European opinion as well, the Austro-German force aimed to attack the Russians in Bulgaria, in Poland, and in Scandinavia, where it was reported that Sweden and Denmark-Norway were susceptible to German offers of an alliance. Through responding to these moves, it was clear the Russians would be plainly unable to stand down and thus unable to adhere to Britain's ultimatum. At this, at 12 midday on the 7th of September 1914, its ultimatum having run out, Britain issued a declaration of war against Russia. The declaration seems to have forced France to act, coming to the aid of its ally as per the terms of the 20-year-old Franco-Russian Entente. Poincaré urged his peers to fulfil that treaty's obligations and defend their allies' interests. French honour, Poincaré insisted, was at stake, and if France abandoned Russia now, then no power would ever rely on French commitments again. His argument seemed to do the trick, and on the 8th of September 1914, France declared war on Germany and on Russia, and French forces were mobilised for an invasion of Alsace-Lorraine. The cult of the offensive, bolstered as it was by French élan, would carry French soldiers to victory. In their haste to bring the war to the Germans, the sensitive issue of the Low Countries was addressed. It was decided that Belgium, Luxembourg and the Netherlands would remain untouched and neutral unless they attacked French or Russian interests. Pressure was also being mounted on the Italian ambassador to declare one way or the other, but for the moment, Rome remained neutral. With both Britain and France now awkwardly occupying different sides of the conflict, Russian pressure for France to mobilise its naval reserves and pool them with those of the Russian Baltic Sea Fleet soon became intense. The naval issue had been an immense sticking point for Britain, and Grey had insisted in the past that the only thing which could induce Britain to make war on its French friend was the imminent danger that France and Russia would pool their naval resources and strike as one against the undefended German coasts. With the Royal Navy now in the Baltic, the threat from the French Navy to the British shores suddenly became acute for the first time in a century. Much scaremongering was put forward by the media, and accusations that the French planned to invade Britain in defence of Russia were widely thrown about. On the 10th of September 1914, with tensions at a breaking point, the appearance of the French Navy off the northern coast of France, having sailed up from the Mediterranean in the previous July, caused immense panic in Britain. When the French Navy failed to respond to a British signal, a warning shot was fired, and when the French responded with a direct attack that paralysed the British gunboat, an emergency wire was cabled to London, since immortalised by both the media and historical record alike, reading, "Under receipt of French attack and in need of immediate assistance, this is not a drill. Request notification of a state of war with France. Mobilise all coastal forces." When news of this incident, the so-called Channel attack, was learned of in the British government, grave decisions were apparently due to be made. Tensions had reached such a point between the once amicable powers that affairs now seemed to suggest war. London could not allow the attack on its gunboat to go unanswered, especially so close to her home domains. So she sent a memo to the French government demanding compensation, and at 11 a.m. on the 12th of September 1914, these demands unanswered for 24 hours, Britain declared war on France. The Great War, building for so many years and so many months and so many weeks, had begun. So what did we think, guys? I, for one, really enjoyed this foray into alternative history, and the keen-eyed among you will be able to notice that I threw in some actual historical figures in there to make it seem more realistic. Would such a scenario have taken place? Who knows, but it is, of course, fun to speculate. Until then, guys, I have been Zach, and this has been a crazy look at what might have been had Gavrilo Princip missed. Thanks for listening, and I'll be seeing you all soon.